The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. The program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this is a special reading of The Week magazine for this final week of 2011. It will be a composite of articles from the December 23rd, 2011 edition, and also some new articles from theweekmagazine.com. And I hope you enjoy the program this week. I also hope you had a wonderful holiday, Christmas or Hanukkah, whichever, and I hope you have a very happy new year. Our first item from the news section this week is entitled, Five Things the World Hated Most About Kim Jong-il. North Korea's dear leader dies at the age of 69 and will likely be remembered as an egotistical despot who was enigmatic, colorful, and cruel. After 17 years of tumultuous rule, North Korean leader Kim Jong-il died Saturday a week ago at the age of 69. The mercurial, enigmatic dictator who came to power when his father, who founded North Korea, died in 1994, was one of the most combative and colorful despots in modern history. As the world debates what's next for the isolated, poverty-stricken North Korea, here's a look at five things that defined Kim Jong-il's rule. His unquestioned absolute authority. There is perhaps no totalitarianism in the world that is as all-embracing as North Korea's, said Michael Hirsch at National Journal. Something like it hasn't existed since Stalin died. The secretive communist nation is remarkable for its apparent lack of dissidents. Though most North Koreans' quality of life is terrible, no detectable undercurrent is pushing for a democratic uprising. In that sense, Kim Jong-il was the most successful dictator in modern history. Second, his habit of blatantly antagonizing South Korea before succeeding his father in 1994, Kim reportedly ordered a 1983 bombing in Myanmar that killed 17 senior South Korean officials and the 1987 bombing of a Korean Air flight that killed 115 passengers, said Reuters. Kim is also suspected of ordering the March 2010 sinking of a South Korean military ship and in November of that same year, the bombing of a South Korea-controlled island, says Barbara Demick and John Gleona in the Los Angeles Times. Immediately following Kim's death, South Korean President Lee Myung-bak put the country's military on high alert. The third item here, his willingness to ignore famine and poverty. When Kim first took power, communist North Korea's economy was in a shambles following the end of the Cold War and the ensuing loss of its trading partners. Then a devastating famine in the 1990s led to the death of about 1 million North Koreans. Even as the population suffered from poverty and famine, Kim continued his father's military first mandate, says the Associated Press, and devoted nearly all of the country's scarce resources to building the world's fifth largest military. The next item, why he'll be remembered. Item number four, his nuclear obsession. North Korea's dear leader frustrated the United States and other global powers with his on-again, off-again approach to talks on giving up nuclear arms for energy and other assistance, says the Associated Press. Meanwhile, North Korea detonated a nuclear device in 2006, conducting a second nuclear test in 2009. Now the world is rightfully terrified about the future future of North Korea's half dozen or so nuclear weapons, says Joby Warrick at the Washington Post. The nukes are both a matter of immense pride and an insurance policy for a regime that sees itself threatened by much larger countries, including the United States. So don't expect Kim's successor to abandon his obsessive pursuit of nuclear weapons. And fifth, his narcissistic personality. Kim Jong-il was a real-life Dr. Evil, intent on being taken seriously and yet almost unfailingly laughed at, says Hirsch. He was strutting and poof-haired, a self-described connoisseur of fine wine and cigars, as well as, according to North Korea's ever-inventive media, a brilliant inventor who shot 38 under par his first time playing golf. He was quite the cinephile as well, says the UK's Telegraph. The near-obsessive film buff boasted a reported collection of more than 20,000 videotapes, and he spared no expense. Kim drank about 450,000 pounds, roughly $700,000 worth of premium cognac, every single year. Our next story from The Week magazine this week, Ron Paul's Iowa Surge. How will it affect the 2012 race? With Newt Gingrich fading fast, GOP presidential hopeful Ron Paul has jumped into the lead heading into the critical January 3rd Iowa caucuses, according to a new survey from Public Policy Polling. The Libertarian congressman from Texas had the support of 23% of the survey's respondents, trailed by Mitt Romney 20%. Gingrich was in third place at 14%, down from 27% just 2 weeks ago. What does Paul's surge mean for the 2012 race? Here are five talking points. The GOP can't ignore Ron Paul. Let's be realistic about that, said David Kurtz in talking memo. A win in Iowa won't propel Paul to the nomination, but it would solidify his status as a significant player at the Republican convention. No shot of winning doesn't mean he's not a factor, and in a year in which all the GOP candidates are deeply flawed, weak or unknown, usually all three, someone with Paul's loyal base of support, reasonably good name recognition, and consistent record could end up being much more of a factor than some people consider. Point number two, if Iowa picks Paul, Romney will be the nominee. If Ron Paul steals the January caucuses, Mitt Romney will be the real winner. You can bet Romney will run the table as Republicans everywhere else, but Iowa recoil in horror. Plus, a Paul victory in Iowa would push Gingrich off the top-tier media narrative and deny Newt an early victory. And remember, next up is the January 10th New Hampshire primary, where Mitt has long held a double-digit lead. If Gingrich goes 0-2, Romney will have all of the momentum. Point number three, Paul is in for a barrage of ugly attacks. It makes sense that Paul leads in Iowa. His supporters have genuine enthusiasm, and that counts in Iowa. But the principled, anti-war, constitution-obeying, Fed-hating, libertarian Republican congressman from Texas stands firmly outside the bounds of permissible dissent as drawn by either the Republican establishment or the mainstream media. If he places first in Iowa, he'll be punished by conservatives and the liberal media alike, with ugly attacks painting him as a racist, a kook, and a conspiracy terrorist. Point number four, a conspiracy theorist, I should say, not terrorist. Point number four, the Libertarian might launch a third-party bid. A big reason for Gingrich's fall has been a month-long onslaught by conservative media and attack ads. If Paul is treated as badly or worse than Newt has been treated, expect a backlash. Paul, who has the support of 10% of the GOP nationally, would have more reason than ever to vindicate his name with a third-party run. Of course, that would dilute the Republican vote and lift President Obama to victory. And point number five. But remember, Iowa doesn't always pick the right horse. The simple truth is about the Iowa caucuses, they just aren't a good indicator of which way the race is going to go. That's especially true on the GOP side. Since 1976, only three candidates who won the Iowa caucuses, where there was actually a contest, went on to win the nomination: Ford in 1976, Dole in 1996, and George W. Bush in 2000. We should listen to the Republican insiders who say Paul's strength in Iowa isn't a big deal. They sort of have a point. Now, in a related article about politics, the GOP endgame: who will drop out after Iowa? There's only a week to go until the crucial January 3rd Iowa caucuses, and if history is any guide at all, by January 4th at least one candidate will call it quits. Which Republican is most likely to quit the presidential race after Iowa? Rick Santorum. He bet everything on Iowa, and he'll lose everything on January 3rd. Michelle Bachmann. If she can't win her birth state, she's toast. Rick Perry. He roared into the GOP race like a lion in August, but will whimper out like a lamb in January. No one's dropping out. This race will drag on well into the spring. The race for the GOP presidential nomination has been a roller coaster ride, with one candidate after another surging and then crashing. Of course, the race is still extremely fluid. Just a week before Iowa kicks off the voting with its first in-the-nation caucuses. But the conventional wisdom still holds, says James Holman at Politico. It's the top three on January 3rd who will get to move on past Iowa. The Hawkeye State rarely chooses either party's nominee, says Chris Siliza at the Washington Post, but it has long served to winnow the field. In 2008, for instance, Democrats Joe Biden and Chris Dodd immediately dropped out after poor Iowa finishes. Recent polls show Ron Paul, Newt Gingrich, and Mitt Romney looking strongest in Iowa. Which GOP hopefuls will throw in the towel after the January 3rd caucuses? Here are the details behind the four predictions. The first one, Rick Santorum. The socially conservative former Pennsylvania senator has bet the farm on Iowa. He has visited all 99 of Iowa's counties and courted every leading religious group in the state, Sam Youngman at Reuters says. He has campaigned from sunrise to sundown in the diners, town halls, and community centers that are so crucial to the type of personal contact that Iowa voters have responded to for generations. But what worked for last cycle's Iowa winner, Mike Huckabee, isn't working for Santorum. He's running no better than a distant fourth in the polls, and even if the top three stumble, it's questionable whether Santorum will be in a position to take advantage. He needs a highly unlikely top two to finish, to keep going, says Siliza. Number two, Michelle Bachmann. After her victory in Iowa's much-hyped Ames straw poll in August, Hawkeye State native Bachmann was the clear front-runner for the Iowa caucuses, says the Washington Post's Siliza. Then her poll numbers crashed. She seems to be recovering some lost ground with a pugnacious message about being a rare, consistent conservative, but she lacks that money to get that message out. Bottom line on Bachmann: without another obvious state where she can win, it's harder to see her as a relevant factor if she can't take first or second on January 3rd. Number three, Rick Perry. Perry has more money than Bachmann or Santorum, and he's barnstorming the state. But he hasn't clawed his way into the magic top three slots in the polls, says Politico's Homan. Without a clear breakout performance, Iowa could be Perry's last stand. Voters in other states simply won't take him seriously if he winds up in fourth place or lower, and especially if he doesn't finish well ahead of Bachmann and Santorum. And the fourth option here is no one would drop out. Contrary to conventional wisdom and recent history, it's possible Iowa may do little to thin the herd of candidates, says Jennifer Rubin at the Washington Post. Candidates who finish in the back of the pack may still win 10% or more of the vote, and in a race this volatile, that's a good enough reason to keep going. And if a toxic crackpot like Paul wins, as seems eminently possible, there's good reason for the entire field to throw up its collective hands, declare the contest irrelevant, and consider New Hampshire to be the first meaningful contest. Our next item from the Week magazine for this week is entitled, When Americans Banned Christmas. The first war on Christmas was declared almost 400 years ago, courtesy of our Puritan forefathers. The pilgrims who came to America in 1620 were strict Puritans who didn't celebrate Christmas. They spent their first December 25th in Plymouth Colony working in the fields as they would on any other day. So how did the first settlers celebrate Christmas? Well, they didn't. The ones who came in 1620 were strict Puritans, with firm views on religious holidays such as Christmas and Easter. Scripture did not name any holiday except the Sabbath, they argued, and the very concept of holy days implied that some days were not holy. They for whom all days are holy can have no holiday, was a common Puritan maxim. Puritans were particularly contemptuous of Christmas, nicknaming it Fool's Tide, and banning their flock from any celebration of it throughout the 17th and the 18th centuries. On the first December 25th, the settlers spent in Plymouth Colony. They worked in the fields as they would on any other day. The next year, a group of non-Puritan workmen, caught celebrating Christmas with a game of stool ball, an early precursor of baseball, were punished by Governor William Bradford. "My conscience cannot let you play while everybody else is out working," he told them. Why didn't Puritans like Christmas? Well, they had several reasons, including the fact that it did not originate as a Christian holiday. The upper classes in ancient Rome celebrated December 25th as the birthday of the sun god Mitra. The date fell right in the middle of Saturnalia, a month-long holiday dedicated to food, drink, and revelry, and Pope Julius I is said to have chosen that day to celebrate Christ's birth as a way of co-opting the pagan rituals. Beyond that, the Puritans considered it historically inaccurate to place the Messiah's arrival on December 25th. They thought Jesus had been born sometime in September. So their objections were theological? Not exclusively. The main reason Puritans didn't like Christmas was that it was a raucously popular holiday in late medieval England. Each year, rich landowners would throw open their doors to the poor and give them food and drink as an act of charity. The poorest man in the parish was named the Lord of Misrule, and the rich would wait upon him at feasts that often descended into bawdy drunkenness. Such decadence never impressed religious purists. "Men dishonor Christ more in the 12 days of Christmas," wrote the 16th century clergyman Hugh Latimer, "than in all the 12 months besides." When did that view win out? Puritans in the English Parliament eliminated Christmas as a national holiday in 1645, amid widespread anti-Christmas sentiment. Settlers in New England went even further, outlawing Christmas celebrations entirely in 1659. Anyone caught shirking their work duties or feasting was forced to pay a significant penalty of 5 shillings. Christmas returned to England in 1660, but in New England it remained banned until the 1680s, when the crown managed to exert greater control over its subjects in Massachusetts. In 1686, the royal governor of the colony, Sir Edmund Andros, sponsored a Christmas Day service at the Boston townhouse. Fearing a violent backlash from Puritan settlers, Andros was flanked by redcoats as he prayed and sang Christmas hymns. Did the Puritans finally relent? Not at all. They kept up their boycott of Christmas in Massachusetts for decades. Cotton Mather, New England's most influential religious leader, told his flock in 1712 that the feast of Christ's nativity is spent in reveling, dicing, carding, masking, and an all licentious liberty, by mad mirth, by long eating, by hard drinking, by lewd gaming, by rude reveling. European settlers and other American colonies continued to celebrate it, however, as both a pious holiday and a time for revelry. In his Poor Richard's Almanac of 1739, Philadelphian Benjamin Franklin wrote of Christmas, "O blessed season, loved by saints and sinners, for long devotions or for longer dinners." So Christmas was finally accepted at that time? No, anti-Christmas sentiment flared up again around the time of the American Revolution. Colonial New Englanders began to associate Christmas with royal officialdom and refused to mark it as a holiday. Even after the U.S. Constitution came into effect, the Senate assembled on Christmas Day in 1797, as did the House in 1802. It was only in the following decades that disdain for the holiday slowly ebbed away. Clement Clark Moore's poem, A Visit from St. Nicholas, also known as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, was published in New York in 1823 to enormous success. In 1836, Alabama became the first state to declare Christmas a public holiday, and other states soon followed suit. But New England remained defiantly Scrooge-like as late as 1850. Schools and markets remained open on Christmas Day. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow finally noted a transition state about Christmas in New England in 1856. The old Puritan feeling prevents it from being a cheerful, hearty holiday, though every year makes it more so, he wrote. Christmas Day was formally declared a federal holiday by President Ulysses S. Grant in 1870. And you're listening to a special reading of The Week magazine for this week between Christmas and New Year's, the last week of 2011. Thanks so much for joining me today. We're going to turn now to the health and science section of the week. Our first item is entitled, The Secrets of Supermassive Black Holes. Astronomers have spotted the most enormous black holes ever detected, inspiring new theories about how such pockets of extreme gravity form. Together, the two objects, which are roughly 300 million light years away, have more mass than 30 billion suns, University of California at Berkeley astrophysicist Chung Pei Ma tells the Associated Press. They are monstrous, she says. The smaller of the two black holes is 54% bigger than any ever found before. Black holes are regions of space where gravity is so intense that not even light can escape. They can form when stars run out of energy and collapse into themselves. Every galaxy, including our own Milky Way, appears to have a black hole at its center. But until now, all of those found have been much smaller. Since these new supermassive finds are far bigger than those left by any single dead star, scientists now wonder if they expanded by gobbling galactic matter or by merging with black holes inside other galaxies. Ma says these black holes might also be remnants of quasars that burned out in the bright bursts of extreme energy during the early phase of the universe. Our next item from the Health and Science section, Taming Temper Tantrums. There's a rhythm to childhood temper tantrums, and understanding it can help parents know when it's best to intervene. In a new study, researchers planted microphones in toddlers' clothes and recorded the sounds of the children made during tantrums. As expected, they heard lots of screams and yells linked to anger and plenty of cries and whimpers expressing sadness. But they were surprised to find that the tantrums did not follow a direct path from an angry to a sad phase. The impression that tantrums have two stages is incorrect. Michael Podigal, a pediatric neuropsychologist at the University of Minnesota, tells NPR.org. The data show, instead, that sad sounds occur throughout a tantrum, punctuated by sharp peaks of anger. During a screaming burst, there's little point in trying to comfort, let alone reason with a child, says Podigal's co-author James A. Green. When children are screaming and kicking, it's difficult for them to process information, even if it comes in the form of a gentle question as to what's wrong. Parents are better off waiting to offer comfort until the toddler's sadder sounds indicate that he or she is actually seeking it. The next item is entitled Closing In on Alien Life. Astronomers used NASA's Kepler Space Telescope say they've discovered the most Earth-like planet yet, and that conditions there could support life as we know it. Kepler-22b, located some 600 light-years away, orbits a star very, very similar to our own Sun, at just the right distance to create surface temperatures of around 72 degrees, Kepler astronomer Natalie Battaglia tells The Washington Post. The planet is 2.4 times the size of Earth, and scientists can't yet say much about its surface or its atmosphere, which could greatly affect temperatures. Even with that caveat, Kepler scientists say the find is more promising than two other Earth-like planets, Gliese, that's G-L-I-E-S-E, 581D, and HD 85512b, which were identified earlier this year by European researchers. Both are thought to be larger and colder than the new find. Kepler-22b is one of 2,326 candidate planets that the Kepler telescope has spotted since it was launched in 2009. Only about 10 of those draw special interest because of their moderate sizes and their orbits within the habitable zone, where temperatures are mild enough to allow water to exist as a liquid. Researchers at the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute have begun examining Kepler-22b with radio telescopes for signs of aliens. We won't know if they're there unless we look, says SETI scientist Jill Tarter. The next item, how fish can fight Alzheimer's. Eating more fish, as long as it's not fried, could help keep your mind sharp as you age. A new study found that 70-year-olds who ate at least one serving of fish per week had bigger brains after 10 years than those who didn't. The difference was most marked in regions linked to learning and memory. Those with more gray matter were also only a fifth as likely to develop Alzheimer's disease. The study backs previous research suggesting that a fish-heavy diet reduces the risk of dementia, but it's the first to establish a direct relationship between fish consumption, brain structure, and Alzheimer's risk. Researcher Cyrus Raj of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center tells WebMD.com. Many experts think the omega-3 fatty acids found in fish reduce the risk of Alzheimer's by improving blood flow to the brain and preventing inflammation. But the new evidence that only baked and broiled fish proved beneficial suggests that other factors could be involved, says neurologist Richard Lipton of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Maybe it's not the fish itself that offers protection, but the tendency of people with healthy eating habits to exercise more or eat less total calories. And the last item from Health and Science this week is the health scare of the week, toxins in apple juice. Many popular apple and grape juices contain arsenic and lead at levels that could be dangerous to children, a study by Consumer Reports shows. The magazine tested 31 popular grocery store brands and found that 1 in 10 samples had arsenic levels higher than the Food and Drug Administration's limit for bottled water. Elevated levels of lead were also found in a fourth of the samples. The FDA previously suggested that juice could safely contain nearly 5 times the arsenic found in bottled water because most people drink less of it. But Jerome Paulson of the American Academy of Pediatrics tells NPR.org that those standards aren't adequate since kids are known to consume more juice per pound of body weight than adults. The findings have prompted the FDA to consider setting much stricter juice standards for both arsenic and lead. Meanwhile, experts urge parents to limit their children's consumption of fruit juices to avoid increasing their risk of cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine. We'll turn to the back of the magazine right now for the very popular section entitled The Last Word. The specific title for this week's Last Word section is Death or Victory. With one race left, says Michael Cannell, American Phil Hill had a shot to be the Grand Prix champion of 1961. They began arriving a day in advance. The loyal Ferrari following, the Tifosi, rolled up in caravans of Fiats and battered motorbikes to camp among the chestnut groves that spread more than 600 acres around the boomerang-shaped racetrack in Monza, Italy. By the glow of evening campfires, they raised cups of grappa to the great drivers, the Pilati, who once thundered around the terrible bank turns of the Autodroma Nazionale. Most of them were gone now. Between 1957 and 1961, 20 Grand Prix drivers had died. Many more suffered terrible injuries. In the days before seat belts and roll bars, they were crushed, burned, and beheaded with unnerving regularity. Inside the Autodromo, half a dozen teams and 32 drivers warmed up for the 267-mile Italian Grand Prix, the climactic race of the 1961 season. The spotlight was focused squarely on Ferrari teammates, drivers Phil Hill and Count Wolfgang von Trips. The next afternoon, on Sunday, September 10th, they would settle their long fight for the Grand Prix title, racing's highest laurel. Von Tripp held a 4-point edge. Points are awarded for first through sixth place finishes, and he had earned the advantageous pole position with the fastest practice laps. Tall, blonde, and blue-eyed, Von Tripp was descended from German nobility, and he cut a glamorous figure, even in Grand Prix circles. He had the comportment of a champion, though he had crashed so many times he was plagued with the nickname Count Von Crash. Hill, a California mechanic and hot rodder, was a solitary man, given to apprehension and self-doubts about racing. He had won at Monza a year earlier, and he had set several lap records. If Von Tripp was the erratic star, Hill was his rock-steady complement. Like any great sports story, it was a pairing of opposites. The two men had traded checkered flags all summer as the Grand Prix made its way through six European countries. Neither one was Italian, which suited Enzo Ferrari, the reclusive white-haired padrone of the Ferrari empire. Every time an Italian driver died, the government launched a meddlesome investigation, and the Vatican made thunderous condemnations. The location only heightened the suspense. The Italians call Monza the Death Circuit, in part because the banked turns catapulted errant cars like cannonballs. The sloped surface was coarse and pockmarked, and it exerted a centrifugal pull that the fragile Formula One cars were not designed to handle. More dangerous still, the long straights allowed drivers to touch 180 miles per hour and to slipstream inches apart. A series of tight curves known as chicanes had been installed to slow the cars, but it was still a track to be driven flat out. On a mild and clear mid-September morning, the drivers went through their pre-race routine, wearing polo shirts and sunglasses. Hill asked a mechanic to splash a bucket of water on the back of his coveralls to keep him cool. Von Tripp was as relaxed as ever, napping on a bench in the corner of the pits. He roused himself and ate a pear as the crew rolled his car into the pole position. The inside slot of the front row marked with a white line on the gray asphalt. It was the only time that Von Tripp had earned the top spot. "We may be teammates," he said of Hill as he adjusted his silver helmet, "but one has to fight. I love fighting." Everything but the fight faded in the closing moments before the start. Mechanics darted about, shouting at one another in four languages. A heaving crowd of 50,000 packed the grandstands and bleachers, pressed against the wire fences at the edge of the 6.2-mile course. It was their moment to see a Ferrari renaissance, to defeat the hated Brits in their Lotus cars. The drivers emerged from the pits in Dunlop coveralls and lowered themselves one by one into their cars. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The Italian flag swung down and the cars leaped. "Hill's car had a stumble to it," he said, "but when the flag dropped, I was gone." Von Tripp had a history of early faltering. It often took him a lap or so to shed his jitters and find his rhythm. True to form, he missed a few beats at the start and mired himself in a pack of six cars following Hill in tight formation, moving inches apart through the broad Curva Grande and the two sharp rights at the Curva dell'Esmo. Von Tripp was in fourth as the group charged down the long backstretch and around the Big South Curve to finish the first lap. With Hill pulling away, Von Tripp surely felt an urgency to maneuver his way up through the tightly bunched field. It was still early, but if he got trapped in traffic, he might forfeit his chance for a top finish, and with it his edge over Hill. With teeth bared, he passed the defending world champion Jack Brabham and Lotus's Jim Clark in two powerful blasts of acceleration. On the second lap, Von Tripp sped through a bend in the backstretch, with Clark trailing behind and slightly to his left. The bend slowed them only slightly as they rolled into the fastest stretch, a straight where drivers could press the accelerator for nearly 30 full seconds. Moving at 150 miles per hour, Von Tripp watched for his chance to pass. 400 feet before the next turn, the German swerved left to make his move. In his haste to catch Hill, he was unaware that Clark had stayed close. He may have assumed that Clark was slipstreaming directly behind him. "In any case, Von Tripp shifted sideways," Clark later said, "so that my front wheels collided with his back wheels." It was the fatal moment. Von Tripp committed a tiny miscalculation, a miscue of no more than an inch. But at 150 miles per hour, it was enough to sling him onto a grassy shoulder to the left. His wheels plowed the soft earth as the car rode up a 5-foot slope where spectators stood too deep behind a chest-high chicken wire fence. In an instant of explosive violence, the Ferrari slashed along the fence for about 10 feet, shredding spectators like a big red razor, then bounced end over end back onto the track. The mauled car came to rest, right side up, with its wheels collapsed inward. Five spectators standing along the fence died instantly, their skulls crushed by the threshing car. The survivors screamed in reaction to the death all around them. Bodies lay in scattered clumps. 10 more would die later. More than 50 were injured. Meanwhile, Clark's Lotus spun and struck the embankment several times before coming to a rest in the grassy stretch beside the road. The car was crushed, but Clark squirmed out unscathed. The man who was supposed to be the Grand Prix champion lay face down on the track in bloodied coveralls, alone and motionless. His car had rolled on top of him, then on the next bounce flung him like a rag doll. His distinctive silver helmet had not saved him, nor had the flimsy roll bar. Clark jumped from his car and helped a race marshal drag Von Tripp's car to the shoulder. He glanced at Von Tripp, but could not bring himself to check on him. "I didn't really want to go over to where he lay," Clark said. With his helmet tucked under his arm, Clark went back to the pits, where he all but collapsed. Von Tripp had died of skull fractures by the time an ambulance arrived. In a few savage seconds, no more than a few heartbeats, all his charm and promise, all the hope he offered to his troubled homeland, came to a violent end. A paramedic spread a sheet over the body. A bloodied forearm dangled from the shroud as Von Tripp was carried to the ambulance on a stretcher. It was the public's last glimpse of him. All over Germany, people froze over their coffee or Pilsner as the radio sportscaster waited for a messenger from the Ferrari pit to explain why the count had not come around on the last lap. Meanwhile, the race flowed on, with Hill leading Moss by 18 seconds. Drivers wove through the smoke and debris, slowed by a marshal waving a flag of caution, while the bloodied bodies were laid out on the roadside, covered in tent canvas and newspapers. No announcement was made to the crowd. Hill passed the scene 41 more times that afternoon. On each lap, he glimpsed the crumpled remains of the car, but he was uncertain whose it was until he saw Von Tripp's name removed from the scoreboard. After Von Tripp crashed, three other Ferraris dropped out. Watching on television in Modena, Enzo Ferrari said, "Abbiamo perduto. We have lost." It was a curious reaction, given that Hill was driving a nearly perfect race, a masterpiece of precision and pacing. Less than 2 hours after Von Tripp crashed, Hill whipped by the checkered flag in first place, the only one of five Ferraris to finish. The win gave Hill 9 points, clinching the championship. He had overcome waves of obstacles, Ferrari's partisanship, a late summer deficit in points, an 11th-hour engine failure, to become the first American to win racing's greatest prize. Among other things, the win resolved the tug-of-war between anguish and ambition that had gripped him for more than a decade. It affirmed a pursuit that he had so often doubted. Hill had arrived at the triumphant moment that had drawn him since childhood like a distant light. The realization that he had prevailed, the wondrous reality of it, came over him that day as a warming relief, a soaring feeling. Hill walked to the victory podium in a throng of pushing, swaying well-wishers. Sweat matted his hair and goggles dangled from his neck. He sipped from a bottle of mineral water and asked about Von Tripp. "I suspected the worst, but it was not until after champagne and congratulations on the victory stand that I was told," he said later. Sports Illustrated reported that Hill sobbed and dashed away as the flashbulbs popped, but he was too inured for that. Hill may have sagged, he may have paled beneath his sooty cheeks, but his face betrayed nothing but stony acceptance. "At the risk of seeming to be callous, I can only say that my emotional defenses are pretty strong," he later wrote. Von Tripp claimed all the morning headlines. The newspapers buried Hill's triumph if they mentioned it at all. The insinuation was that Von Tripp was the rightful winner. Hill was merely an understudy, despite 2 first-place finishes, 2 seconds and 2/3. The New York Times printed an account of Von Tripp's death on its front page. Mention of the new champion waited until after the story jumped to page 33. "He knows that his victory has been so submerged in the press under the death toll," the reporter wrote, "that few people even realize that he is the champion." And that article was copyrighted in 2011 by Michael Cannell and reprinted courtesy of 12. It was excerpted from The Limit, Life and Death of the 1961 Grand Prix Circuit. And now from the Week magazine for this last week of 2011, we will turn to the art section here for a review of reviews all about books. We think you'll find this interesting. The book of the week this week and the Week magazine is Howard Cosell, The Man, The Myth, and the Transformation of American Sports. And the book was written by Mark Hrabowski. How could it be that a human spectacle as unique as Howard Cosell has already been widely forgotten, said Richard Sandomir in the New York Times. With his adenoidal Brooklyn voice, polysyllabic vocabulary, and vulpine presence, the late sportscaster was the dominant personality in his field for 20 years at a time when holding a network throne meant something. He was loud, audacious, obnoxious, perspicacious, brilliant, narcissistic, provocative, and haughty. Qualities that both lifted him to prominence and contributed to his downfall. For those who remember hearing him, Cosell slowly enunciated signature sign-off. This is Howard Cosell will be ringing in their ears as they flip through the pages of Mark Hrabowski's vivid, if sometimes overexcited, biography. Was there anyone who didn't do an impression of that voice in the 1970s? Asked Gene Warner in the Buffalo News. Hrabowski's nuanced and complex portrait accurately captures a man so divisive that he once won both most loved and most loathed television personality in the same poll. He certainly wasn't afraid to irritate audiences. A Manhattan lawyer before making the unlikely career jump into sports broadcasting, he rose to national prominence in the 1960s thanks largely to his on-air rapport with Muhammad Ali, who, when he adopted his Muslim name, had few defenders in broadcasting besides Cosell. Later, as part of the first team to host Monday Night Football, Cosell won the enmity of NFL fans by using 50-cent words to deride players, playing black hat, white hat with his affable co-host, former Dallas Cowboys quarterback Don Meredith. Even if you loathed him, Cosell's performance was what made Monday nights memorable, said David Remnick in The New Yorker. As a Hrabowski points out, Cosell was also a real journalist, a blunt questioner who used his sports beat to address the more pressing issues of the day. In the early 80s, the suits at ABC gave Cosell the boot after finally tiring of his self-aggrandizing and habit of drinking on the job. Hrabowski's biography, which follows the story to its sad end, is too loaded with florid prose to be called a great book, but it does remind us that Cosell was a singular figure. These days, it's nearly impossible to imagine someone on the air who is, at once, an impresario, a circus barker, an analyst, and a serious journalist. Cosell is the only one who has managed the feat, and he's never been replaced. And this week in the art section and the book section of the Week magazine, the novel of the week is entitled Death Comes to Pemberley, and it's by P.D. James. At 91, the great P.D. James has just established herself as heir apparent to Jane Austen's creative legacy, said Carol Mamott in USA Today. Many have tried before to emulate the 19th century legend's tone and plotting finesse, but the doyen of British crime fiction has outdone them with this perfect crime thriller. 6 years after the marriages that end Pride and Prejudice, Mr. Darcy and his bride, Elizabeth, are living in wedded bliss at Pemberley when Elizabeth's sister, Lydia, arrives at the estate one night to inform them of the murder of a friend. Austen fans need no reminder of the trouble Lydia brought to her family in the original novel. Nothing apparently has changed. James' faultless replication of Austin's writing style lifts her above the ever-growing pack of Austin imitators, said Fran Wood in the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger. But Death Comes to Pemberley is not just a tribute, it's a first-rate murder mystery. The eventual trial will offer twists you won't see coming. And the next book that's featured in this week's Week magazine is Gossip, The Untrivial Pursuit by Joseph Epstein. Once upon a time, gossip was a nasty but rare treat, said Boris Kochka in New York. Not anymore, says Joseph Epstein in his witty new book about the ways we chatter about others. The conservative essayist, who has produced previous books about snobbery and envy, bemoans not gossip's ubiquity, but the current nature of its ubiquity. Epstein freely professes his love for gossip, even engaging in his fair share of it here. But in examining the history of rumor-mongering from the ancient Greeks to Kim Kardashian, he seems saddened, most because he senses that fewer and fewer secrets are held as the exclusive property of social insiders. There's surely some snobbery in that complaint. But one can't worry much about conclusions when reading Epstein, said Henry Allen in the Wall Street Journal. Like a good stand-up comedian, the erudite septuagenarian inspires confidence, but also a sense of anxiety that he's making it up as he goes along. Try as he might, he never even arrives at a concise definition of gossip. Yet he fails so wittily and gracefully that one hardly notices. Which is not to say he's polite. Epstein has the gift of turning cruelty into entertainment, and he's not above dishing on the alleged sexual habits of Jackie Kennedy, Susan Sontag, J. Edgar Hoover, or Princess Diana. Put aside the book's tired narrative about cultural decline, and Epstein mostly champions gossip, said Isaac Chotiner in Slate.com. Anyone who possesses no interest in gossip, he writes, is wanting in curiosity and uninterested in the variousness of human nature. Sure, gossip can spring from the wish to harm someone else's reputation, but the motive can also be constructive, said Allison Yarrow in the DailyBeast.com. To Epstein, the core function of gossip is to enforce moral norms. For most of us, simply the threat of chatter is enough to prevent bad behavior. Research also suggests that speaking behind others' backs can enhance psychological well-being. So, don't feel guilty the next time you gossip. Epstein would say that you might actually be doing good. And those items are from the Book of the Week section in the Week magazine. And during the coming year in 2012, we'll try to include more about the novels and the books of the week featured in the Week magazine. One thing I would like to point out to you is during 2012, you will have the opportunity to hear a program about the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped that's been produced here by the Triangle Radio Reading Service. It will be aired numerous times throughout the year, and it gives great information about the North Carolina Library for the Blind. It talks about the new digital talking book service, the large print books, the Braille books, and the descriptive video service, as well as other services available absolutely free to anyone who is blind or visually impaired, or physically impaired for that matter. We'll be playing the program numerous times here on the service, and I hope you will have the opportunity to listen to it. We'll be letting you know with the promotional announcements when the program will be running. Now, a couple of items from the Talking Points section of the Week magazine as we reach the end of the program and our final program for the year 2011. The first item is, would Hillary Clinton have been a better president than Obama? With liberals still irate over President Obama's chronic caving to Republicans during Washington's debt ceiling crisis, pesky questions have resurfaced. On Friday's Real Time with Bill Maher, the politically incorrect pundit asked his panel, "Do you think people on the left are having buyer's remorse about the president?" And the question, fine-tuned with a focus on Hillary Clinton as the erstwhile Obama alternative, has since inspired plenty of commentary. Should Democrats have picked Clinton instead? Many liberals think Hillary wouldn't have caved. In recent days, says Leslie Bennett at the Daily Beast, the whispers about Obama's failings have swelled to an angry chorus of frustration. The Democratic Party's liberal stalwarts are furious about Obama's perceived weakness and heartbroken at how ineffectual he seemed in dealing with Republican opponents over the debt ceiling. Many are particularly incensed by Obama's capitulation to conservatives on fundamental liberal principles. They believe Hillary would have stood firm. And now, arguably, Hillary is the Dems' best hope in 2012. Clinton warned voters in 2008 about the danger of being duped by Obama's rhetoric and the perils of having such an inexperienced leader, said Matthew Dickinson at Presidential Power. Now we have an unpopular president mired deep in the political muck of Washington. The best solution, Hillary should run in 2012. Sure, a contested nomination would be a nasty, brutish spectacle, but the still popular Clinton, who had no involvement with Obama's unpopular domestic record, has far fewer liabilities than her struggling boss. Not so fast. It's hardly a sure thing that Clinton would have avoided Obama's misstep, says Joan Walsh at Salon. Sure, she would have known from the start the extent to which the right wing would go to sabotage a Democratic president. But a Hillary presidency also risked becoming a dreaded sequel to the ugly Clinton wars, full of 90s-style partisan warfare. And remember, it's not Obama's fault that the Tea Party took over the GOP. And a couple of short items as we reach the end of the program. Federal prisons hold 362 inmates convicted of terrorism, including 269 with connections to international terrorist groups. By comparison, only 171 detainees remain at Guantanamo. Families of 9/11 victims say a design for a pair of high-rise buildings in Seoul cruelly evokes the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, with a cloud of jumbled blocks coming out of each tower. It looks like the tower's imploding, said Jim Riches, the father of a fireman who died there. The Dutch firm that designed the buildings, due to be completed in 2015, said no association with the Twin Towers was intended. And cremation is now chosen over burial in 41% of American deaths, up from 15% in 1985. The increase is being driven partly by a desire to save on funeral expenses, since a typical cremation costs about $1,500, while a traditional casket, wake, and burial usually exceed $10,000. And our poll watch for this week, 54% say that President Obama has done his job well enough to deserve re-election. And that particular poll was conducted by CBS News. And we have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. I'd like to take this opportunity to wish you a very, very happy new year and a prosperous 2012. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time and next year.